currently held up by the United States export restrictions and tools such as genomic sequencing to identify and control existing and emerging variants of the virus. One hopeful sign is that the United States has promised to rapidly deploy aid to healthcare workers in India, where there has been a fourth consecutive day of world record COVID case numbers. The United States said it was in high-level talks to deploy extra help to Indian healthcare workers and that it was gravely concerned about the situation in India. Dr. Anthony Fauci, America's top infectious disease expert, said on Sunday, 25th of April, several measures are being considered, including sending over oxygen supplies, tests, drug treatments and personal protective equipment, PPE. Bottom line, it's a terrible situation that's going on in India and other lower middle-income countries, and there is more that we can do, Dr. Anthony Fauci said. Meanwhile, India's daily coronavirus death toll passed a new record on Saturday, 24th of April, as the government battled to get oxygen supplies to hospitals overwhelmed by the hundreds of thousands of new daily cases. Queues of COVID-19 patients and their fearful relatives are building up outside hospitals in major Indian cities. The new world pandemic hotspot, which has reported nearly a million new cases in just 3 days. Another 2,624 deaths, a new daily record, were reported in the last 24 hours, taking India's official death toll to nearly 190,000 since the pandemic started. More than 340,000 new cases were also reported, taking India's total to 16.5 million, second only to the United States. But many experts are predicting that the current wave will not peak for at least another 3 weeks, and that the real death toll and case numbers are much higher. Stung by criticism of its lack of preparation ahead of a wave of coronavirus infections, the central government in India has organized special trains to get oxygen supplies to the worst-hit cities. It has also pressed industrialists to increase production of oxygen and life-saving drugs that are in short supply. One Oxygen Express train carrying 30,000 litres of oxygen for hospitals arrived in Lucknow in Uttar Pradesh province at dawn on Saturday, where armed guards were waiting to escort trucks to hospitals. Lucknow has been one of the worst hit cities in India, with hospitals and crematoriums inundated with patients and bodies, and officials said the liquid oxygen would only be enough for half a day's needs. The Indian Air Force is also being used to transport oxygen tankers and other supplies around the country. In New Delhi itself, the city's government said it would begin setting up buffer stocks of oxygen to speed supplies to hospitals when they are within hours of running out. Many patients are dying outside hospitals in the capital, New Delhi, because of the lack of beds and oxygen. One charity has set up an overflow crematorium in a car park, with makeshift funeral pyres built to deal with the mounting deaths.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Let It Fall, LA 1982 to 1992, directed by John Ridley. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Suresh Grover, who is the director of the Monitoring Group, which is a leading anti-racist charity here in the UK that promotes civil rights. Now, Let It Fall provides an in-depth look at the racial tensions in Los Angeles in the 10 years leading up to the 92 riots, which erupted after the acquittal of four police officers charged in the brutal beating of Rodney King. The riots caused a lot of destruction in the streets of LA, which resulted in the deaths of more than 50 people, who were mostly black, injured over 2,000, and caused at least $1 billion worth of damages.
The Los Angeles police officially reprimanded Police Chief Darrell Gates.
We were having deaths from the chokehold.
He didn't get along with the community.
In the early 80s, the street gangs started to connect with the drug dealers.
It just got out of control.
Karen Tashima was killed in gang crossfire.
This is something that you always see on the news, and this time it happened to us.
We are determined to take back the streets of Los Angeles.
Operation Hammer was a free ticket to go out there and do overly aggressive police work.
What I witnessed at the scene was 100% LAPD policy.
Soon Ja Do, found guilty of killing a 16-year-old girl, received no jail time.
She got away with murder.
Black and brown people are being beat up, shot, choked to death by police forces all over this country.
We, the jury, find the defendant not guilty.
You just disrespect us like this? Like our lives don't matter?
Not guilty, the verdict for all of them.
We were sort of stunned.
We need to back out of here before we have to use deadly force.
It's like pouring gasoline and striking a match. It's not protesting anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
I was a part of a movement, a black movement. It's a Florence and Normandy in every city and every state.
It was just one of those days compassion wasn't handed out to other races.
God told me to go save them, save that man's life.
You talked about guerrilla warfare, and it's right here.
18-year-old Edward Song Lee was shot to death.
It doesn't seem real. It felt like it couldn't be happening to us.
I know the anger, and I know exactly what my people are feeling.
We've lost the city. It's gone.
I want to know why God let this happen.
Unity, empowerment, they're not just cliches. We have to get ourselves together.
Thank you very much for coming on the show, very much welcome here. And when you watch this documentary, you feel an overwhelming sense of injustice against black people in the US. And another thing that's striking about this documentary is that it's an oral history as told through many different perspectives and angles, through police officers, jurors, and a whole host of others, the victims and families of the victims. And Lee, if I can start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you've sort of identified what makes it unique and what makes it particularly probing is it's an inside story. So the filmmakers, they don't go to pundits and people from the outside. Every single person you hear from was within the story. They're part of the story, whether they're perpetrators or victims or police or, you know, lost loved ones. And that and keeping to that very tight focus, I think, really, I mean, obviously up to the emotional side of the stories because people are talking about their direct personal involvement, but it gives you that unique perspective because we're not trying to hear from, you know, professors and cultural critics outside it. We stay very much within the story, and I think that's a really great move. The other thing that's great is he doesn't identify who's who. So you start hearing from people, you might then find that they were a policeman who was, you know, inflicted some violence, or, you know, an African American who was involved in, you know, hurting a white American. And by doing that and saving the sort of the revelation, you get to just hear who these people are before you, otherwise you might just immediately identify them as, oh, racist police officer, mm-hmm. or, you know, violent African American. And of course what you're hearing is a more sort of multifaceted side to each of these stories, and I think that's a real strength in the film.
That is indeed a great strength, and you hear their personal stories. And I enjoyed that progression, and you feel a connection to all these characters. And Suresh, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Let It Fall?
I think it's a rich history, or almost a forensic examination of a decade before the so-called uprisings. I wouldn't call it, I use the word uprising, and there's a reason for it. I think it tries to focus on what took place, what incidents took place which led to the build-up of the riots, which is very important. The context is very, very important. And even in this country, when there are public disturbances taking place, people only look at one trigger moment that started the stuff, rather than the history of relationship between the black communities and the police, for example.
So you're saying this context, this build-up is very important.
The context is absolutely critical. I mean, you know, the police commissioner's views about baton charges, metal baton charges, choke holds, and he tries to describe black people not suffering as much as the white people in terms of that. It's just sheer racism, in my view. It unmasks the real relationship between the authorities and people who live in the area, who took part in it and who survived in it.
Of course, LA was a very iconic city, it still is, but particularly at that time because of the Olympics, and they even had their first black mayor. So who would know, underneath the surface, that all this racial tensions was bubbling?
Well, I think what he's trying to point out is that it's unmasked, but actually people who live in it know exactly what's happening, including the police office and the mayor and the police commissioner. So although the story in cinematic terms is being told through different eyes, what is clear is that the bubble and the bubbling and the simmering and of dissent and the relationship souring between different authorities is actually very, very open and pertinent, and people are turning a blind eye to it. For example, you know, the chokehold is being criticized by everyone. It's actually made illegal. So what do the police do? Instead of decreasing their powers, they increase their powers by using a metal baton. And they use both taser and, I mean, youth.
And I'll have to pause you there. We'll go into that detail later on.
One of the many issues that came up during his time as the chief was the chokehold. It was a controversy for a long, long time in the media.
The Los Angeles Police Commission late today officially reprimanded Police Chief Darrell Gates for comments he made last month about black people and a police restraint method.
Chief Gates said, in some blacks, when it is applied, the veins or arteries do not open up as fast as they do in normal people.
That's asinine. That's insanity. That I still to this day can't believe someone said that. And, of course, that raised a firestorm.
There is a direct parallel between the disproportionate killing of black people in this city and the irresponsible remarks of the chief of police.
There was truly shocking comments made by the LAPD police chief at the time, Darrell Gates. And of course, we learn a bit later on in the documentary that he refused to apologize for those comments. And he gave a sort of apology for people being offended, which is hardly an apology. Lee, what was your reactions watching those comments being made?
Well, I mean, they're horrific, and Darrell Gates. I mean, this area and this time in American history and leading up to the riots, there's been a number of films made on this in the last few years, and so the film goes over. You know, if you're familiar with those films, a lot of familiar ground. So Darrell Gates has been vilified, very rightly so, a lot of the time. What's very interesting about this film is there's a section towards the end where they show that his son himself was addicted to drugs. And it's not letting him off the hook in any shape or form, but it's giving you another side to this person who is very easy otherwise to just demonize as, you know, the big bad guy. And don't get me wrong, his policies and his, you know, his stance is you know, you can't justify it in any way. But what's really interesting about the film is it tries to sort of look at people from different angles and maybe give facets of them you didn't know about without excusing it, but you know, you go, okay, well then this guy has some other issues going on at the time. Now again, it's really trying to look at things from a wider angle than you maybe have seen in the past.
And Suresh, would you agree with what Lee said just there? What did you make of these comments being made?
Life is complicated, people are very complicated. I've been in riots in Southall in the 70s, and I know people are complicated. But to justify, I'm not saying Lee is justifying it, I don't want to give an air of justification. To me, the comment about the chokehold and not apology was sheer racism, and there's no excuse for it. He's a senior police officer. He's a senior police officer who should be held accountable for his comments and his practices and procedures. Yes, he's a human being, but we're beyond that in that environment. So when I live in areas like South, which is where I come from, which is Hadriyat, right, I expect police officers to be totally professional. What I don't expect them to do is to blame the victim or the communities that are victimized by police officers because of their racism. And it's happened not just to black people, to, I mean, I did a case of Blair Peach, who was killed by the SPG in 1979. You know what the police said? He had a thin cranium, that's why he died. And they used a lead gauge baton to kill him in 1979. In Mark Duggan's case, what did they say? Honest but mistaken belief. So there's a justification that takes place perpetually by the mainstream and politicians. I do not want to excuse that. Yeah. That doesn't mean, cinematically, people can't look at the complicated picture and come to a resolution. But our society is divided between people who have power and who don't have power.
That's
really important to look at.
And Lee, I want to ask you, in picking up on your point, do you think Ridley was sympathetic in any way to the riots through this film? Do you get the idea that the police are in fact the problem, that the riots or uprisings didn't happen out of a vacuum, that people just became crazy one day?
No, I mean, the whole 10-year time frame, as Suresh has noted, it gives you the context and it gives you a lot of understanding of why tensions within the communities and between the police and not just the African-American community, the Korean-American community, Japanese-American, it's a very, you know, diverse picture that this film paints. I think Ridley is very... he's an interesting figure because he's kind of known as a bit of a polemicist. Mm-hmm. You know, he wrote a very controversial piece for a magazine about 10 years ago using the N-word and criticizing his own community, you know, with 12 Years a Slave, which he wrote
the
screenplay
for.
Yeah, him and the director had a big falling out. And I was surprised, actually, at how much empathy this shows. It's not his usual sort of... you know, mode of speaking, if you like. He's very much into controversy usually and stirring things up, and I felt that this was a much more restrained and, you know, trying to be more empathetic. Look at it. He doesn't let anybody off the hook. So as I said, you don't identify some of the people speaking, and then you find that actually some of these guys were the guys who dragged the white truck driver out of the van and, you know, nearly killed him. Similarly with the police, you see some people making some very, you know, reasonable statements, and you find out they're absolutely part of the endemic racism of the LA police force. So I was very interested at getting that sort of, you know, empathetic thing. And again, without letting anybody off the hook, and, you know, there is clear racism going on there without any shadow.
Well, of course, and it's interesting that so many interpretations can come out of this, and I guess that's a testament to the documentary. And Lee, as we heard in the documentary, one of the police officers in charge at the time told his police officers to avoid that area. Were they effectively then abandoning their duty to protect and serve?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm certainly no expert on police tactics and what you should and shouldn't do, but there was a very clear, you know, decision taken to pull out, and obviously that creates a vacuum, and that allows a lot more things potentially to go on that maybe would be restricted if there was a police presence there. But I mean, this is just part of the chaos. I mean, what it does, it really gives you a picture of the absolute chaos that happened within those 2 days. I was actually in LA probably a couple of weeks after these events, and I was actually walking around through South Central LA. I'd never been in a sort of supposedly peaceful community that had such an air of foreboding and tension. And so it was still, you know, just absolutely in the air, really, really unnerving. So I can only imagine what it would have been like on the 2 days in question. Again, that's no excuse not to get the police in there, because that effectively is their job, to try and maintain, you know, some sort of, you know, so that things don't just descend into utter chaos. But it obviously had a huge impact on the events of those 2 days.
And Suresh, why didn't the police go to the area? Were you surprised by their reaction? Were they intimidated by the riots?
I wasn't surprised at all by the reaction. It's a very common police practice in a public disturbance to leave an area on its own. You know, public disturbances and riots raise a number of issues, and one of them is, why is it that law-abiding citizens living in that area destroy their town?
But they have genuine grievances.
I've been involved, as I said, I've participated in public disturbances. The trigger for me has been racists coming in and the police not stopping them, and then the police arresting us on a continuous basis. And
so the victims,
there's a time
the
bomb that comes. And when you are there, you realize the danger that exists. You realize the chaos that exists. You realize that you live in the area and you're breaking up a shop and that you're fighting with the police. You actually realize it's very conscious. It's not as if it's unconscious and there's got nobody's in control. It's frightening. And it's only people who participate in it, who want to create a message, actually win the day. So you create those areas where the police can't enter for a specific period, for a specific reason. And that is to say that if we are not hurt, and if after all, even according to, you know, the apostle of peace, Martin Luther King, riots are the voices of the unheard, which is actually what they are. Yes, you have sterile areas created by the police. In the same way, you have policing of what you call saturation policing, which they talk about in the earlier period, which is indiscriminate arrests at certain times to create fear in community.
It was Project Hammer, I think, they called it in the documentary, Operation Project Hammer.
Yeah, I mean, in this country, they call it saturation policing. Mm. And we've, in BRICS...
Well, we'll just pause there for now. John Ridley talking during an ABC radio interview with Amna Nawaz about the prospect of another uprising.
Worry there could be similar kinds of level of riots or uprisings and
absolutely
that, yeah.
You know, look, whether how the scope and scale, how big they are, how pervasive they are, you know, again, you know, Los Angeles is a city, how it was policed, and I don't even mean the psychology of it, just the numbers, the demographics, what the capacities were, it's very, very different. It was very, very singular. So I have no doubt in terms of interactions, in terms of what happens in communities, how we look at each other, you know, that we know. I mean, we just know that there are issues, whether that results in a large-scale uprising, whether it results in a few individuals spilling out on the streets, mm-hmm. whether that is a public demonstration where police and citizenry are going out together to say, look, there's an issue and we got to deal with it, or whether it's just people who feel like they're fed up. You know, how it happens, what the results are, that I can't predict, but I'm absolutely sure that there are stress points, that there are people who feel like they're being marginalized, they're not being listened to somewhere right now, and they are going to want recourse. We need to make sure that that recourse is positive, it's real engagement, because otherwise, you know, when you take away people's voices, when you take away their ability to be heard, they will make themselves heard in any way that they feel is appropriate.
Lee, you were just saying earlier how much of an activist Ridley is. What did you make of his comments there in that radio interview?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. You know, historically, he's done these, you know, he's had these moments where people have been very critical of what he's done. People change. And I think he would probably say that he's not the same filmmaker or maybe even person that he was when he did these other projects. And fair play to him. You know, if we're discussing this particular film, I think it's a really balanced, restrained, empathetic portrait that really tries to get to the, you know, the hub of a wide range of issues. So, you know, I can only kind of agree with everything he's saying. And it's also, I think the other thing is, we hear so much about this one time in LA. I would love to hear similar projects about other cities in the US and also in other countries. It's not just America that has systemic, you know, issues with its police force and racism stuff. It's happening all over the world. And it would be great if there were, you know, similar projects as detailed and nuanced that covered other areas. I know more about, you know, Rodney King and Natasha Harlins than I do about some of the, you know, the issues that have happened in this country simply because of proliferation of documentaries and studies about this time. It's all important, mm-hmm. but I'd also like to see other areas and other countries covered in a similar way.
That's interesting. Of course, this year marks 25 years since the LA riots. Perhaps this is why the emergence of these documentaries are coming out. But Suresh, I'd like to ask you, actually, what are some of the differences or similarities between the US and the UK when it comes to institutional police racism and how they treat black people?
Let's look at the similarities. I think the British police has been found to be institutional racism because of the McPherson inquiry in 1999. And there hasn't been enough work done by the police to show that they haven't, they've actually dealt with it properly. You've seen in this country, just like America, although the proportion of killings in America is much, much, much greater. You have something like 16 deaths a day. Mm-hmm. You don't have the same frequency, but it's a smaller black population than America. The American population has been there longer. I think what you really have in similarity is the lack of accountability of the police force, the manner in which police almost get away with murder or police brutality. Nobody's actually held account in a public arena.
Of course, this is why what caused the riots, effectively the straw that broke the camel's back, was that there was videotape evidence of Rodney King's brutal beating,
I think
the police officers walked free.
Yeah, they walked free in Rodney Clay's case as far as the district was concerned. But obviously, as you know, two people were convicted in the federal court, the subsequent trial.
Of course,
and there are important points to make on the judiciary as well in this trial.
The whole criminal justice
system.
The
differences are that just the black American political process of being there for a long time, of developing resistance of black power politics is much more deep-seated than in this country. But this country has this glass ceiling which does not see pivotal figures in the black community just as important as the black, as the Americans would do in terms of black. For example, people like Hugh Newton in the black power movement. There are equivalents in this country. And just like this film, there's a film called Hard Stop on Totem Riots, mm-hmm. which is a fascinating, moving film mm-hmm. of the killing of Duggan told through the eyes of his two friends. It's a fascinating film. It could be much better if it was given more finances. Mm-hmm. So there are attempts being made. But I think this country neglects and actually does not acknowledge the skills that black communities have in their communities, young people, mm-hmm. women, and children.
So there's much work to be done, I suppose. And unfortunately, we're reaching the end of the program now. And Lee, just the final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I've seen quite a number of the recent films that either touch on this specific area or, you know, institutional racism. And I would say it's one of the more thorough and nuanced films. I would also recommend the Made in America film, which mm-hmm. again covers similar things. But it really is, when people actually, it's proper journalism. And it's also good filmmaking. And when you put those together, you know, you really do allow viewers to get a better understanding. And then hopefully that's what you can build on to sort of, you know, change things in the future.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on to Doc Review. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden, in announcing an ostensible end to the U.S. war in Afghanistan, continued to pay eloquent lip service to progressive causes while maintaining the implied status quo, says Sonali Kolhatkaraplil, writer, in an article published under the heading, Dishonesty of Biden's Afghanistan Pullout Vow. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. U.S. President Joe Biden, in announcing an ostensible end to the U.S. war in Afghanistan, continued to pay eloquent lip service to progressive causes while maintaining the implied status quo. In a televised address from the White House on April 14th, Biden said, "It's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home." But just a day later, the New York Times reported without a hint of irony that the Pentagon, American spy agencies, and Western allies are refining plans to deploy a less visible but still potent force in the region. This means the United States is ending the war, but not really. U.S. military leaders and generals gave a much more accurate assessment of the war's future in the days following Biden's speech. Counterterrorism expert Mark Polymore Populous, a former officer of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, explained to the Times, "What we are really talking about are how to collect intelligence and then act against terrorist targets without any infrastructure or personnel in the country other than essentially the embassy in Kabul." In other words, the U.S. wants to wage a remotely run war against Afghanistan, as it has done in other nations such as Yemen, Syria, and Somalia. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin added 2 cents, underscoring the United States' ability to wage war without troops on the ground, saying, "There is probably not a space on the globe that the United States and its allies can't reach." Marine Corps General Kenneth McKenzie Jr. echoed this sentiment in ominous terms on April 20th at a hearing of the House of Representatives Armed Services Committee, saying, "If we are going to strike something in Afghanistan, we are going to strike it in concert with the law of armed conflict and the American way of war." One may suppose that this American way of war is unlike a traditional war where troops occupy a country, a type of war that is generally deeply unpopular with the U.S. public. By publicly promising a withdrawal of troops while quietly continuing airstrikes, Biden is ensuring that U.S. violence against Afghanistan remains invisible to the American people. In other words, America's destructive involvement in Afghanistan predates by decades the post-9/11 invasion and occupation that continues to this day. Instead of owning up to the havoc the U.S. has wreaked in Afghanistan, Biden wants credit for withdrawing troops from a war his country has been involved since 1970s, not 2001, and that will most certainly not end by September 11, 2021. According to Naeem, political expert, the CIA has thousands of militias operating in Afghanistan, and there are still thousands of contractors whose objective Afghans don't even know. He summarized, "It's going to be very naive and simplistic to think that the war will end." Gaez, who has traveled to Afghanistan numerous times to oversee humanitarian aid projects, has seen firsthand what the private contractors represent. She said, "They have CIA clearance and weapons, and they can be used as a partial military force. In fact, the private military contractors outnumber U.S. troops by so much that more contractors than soldiers have died." The U.S. government's Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, that is SIGAR, has warned that the pullout of contractors could have worse consequences than the withdrawal of troops. The most disingenuous aspect of Biden's speech was his insistence that the U.S. had a simple goal in Afghanistan and had met it. He said, "We went to Afghanistan in 2001 to root out Al-Qaeda, to prevent future terrorist attacks against the United States planned from Afghanistan. And that our objective was clear. But the U.S. did far more than that. It foisted its idea of democracy onto a people struggling with U.S.-backed armed warlords and thus ensure that the secular democratic movements remain weak. Along the way, it killed more than 40,000 Afghan civilians, most likely an underestimate. Biden claimed that in 2001 the cause was just, and I supported that military action. Then, encompassing the disastrous war into a single simplistic sentence, Biden claimed, "We delivered justice to Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden a decade ago, and we've stayed in Afghanistan for a decade since." With these words, the U.S. president offered a tantalizing characterization of the Afghan war, that the U.S. intended to root out terrorism, that the task was achieved, and that it should have left soon after. It is a comforting thought for Americans to reimagine the Afghan war through such a benevolent lens, as if U.S. people only gaffe was that they stayed too long. Biden also made absolutely no mention of the fact that bin Laden was captured and killed in Pakistan, not Afghanistan. Missing from the political dialogue over the war is just how obscenely Americans have paid to fight this futile 20-year battle. According to the Cost of War project run by Brown University, American taxpayers have thus far forked over more than $2.2 trillion for a war in Afghanistan that Biden wants Americans to believe achieved its objective by assassinating bin Laden a decade ago in Pakistan. At a time when inequality continues to rise in the United States, and politicians claim there is no money to fund infrastructure projects or a Green New Deal or Medicare for all, the cost of the Afghan war will continue to rise in both economic and human terms. Taxpayers will continue to foot the bill for airstrikes and private contractors with no end in sight. Afghans will continue to suffer and die.
Occupied city of Jerusalem Al-Quds has seen regular clashes over the past week between Palestinian residents and Israeli military forces who have been blocking Palestinians from sitting on the steps of Damascus Gate. This is while thousands of Palestinians traditionally sit in the area following nighttime prayers during the holy Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. On Thursday, the Israeli regime forces attacked Palestinians who gathered outside of the Damascus Gate on the north side of the occupied old city of Jerusalem Al-Quds. That ignited protests against restrictions on their Palestinians' gatherings in Jerusalem Al-Quds' old city during the fasting month of Ramadan. Scores of Palestinians were injured at the Damascus Gate of the old city of Jerusalem Al-Quds as Palestinian activists confronted hundreds of far-right and extremist Israeli settlers chanting death to Arabs in their rally in the center of the occupied city. Palestinian protesters, angered by chants of death to Arabs from far-right Jewish demonstrators, clashed repeatedly with Israeli police. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said in a statement that at least 105 Palestinians were injured, including 22 people who were hospitalized. Also, Israeli forces arrested at least 50 Palestinians during the clashes. The Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas denounced the violence against Palestinians, saying that he holds the Israeli regime accountable for this serious deterioration. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has denounced Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Jerusalem outlets, expressing its solidarity with the victims. Meanwhile, dozens of rockets were fired from the Gaza Strip towards Israel in alliance with protesters and outlets. Israeli media said that the Palestinian resistance movement fired 36 rockets toward the occupied territories. Israeli authorities claimed that most of the rockets had struck open areas, while only six of the projectiles had been intercepted by the Iron Dome missile defense system. Israel responded by carrying out airstrikes across the besieged coastal sliver.
I think what's going on is that there has been a continuation of violence, state violence, by the Israeli occupation forces against the Palestinians, against the indigenous people. And it is the latest chapter, if you like, of what's actually been going on in terms of that. And this idea of the Zionists trying to take over that land, take over that place, is something that is continuing unabated. And it is something that needs to be recognized for what it is that they are actually doing.
Israel lays claim to the entire Jerusalem outlets, but the international community views the city's eastern sector as occupied territory, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state. According to the UN Security Council Resolution 478, other member states are prohibited from establishing diplomatic missions in Jerusalem outlets. The resolution states that the Council does not recognize Jerusalem outlets as the occupying Israeli regime's capital. Palestinians who seek an independent state in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, with East Jerusalem outlets as its capital, have condemned the U.S. pro-Israel agenda. During the former U.S. President Donald Trump, Israel stepped up its settlement expansion in defiance of the U.N. Security Council Resolution 2334. According to the resolution, settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem outlets are illegal. Also, several countries, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, normalized their relations with the Israeli regime by signing the U.S. brokered Abraham Accords. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem outlets. All of them are illegal under international law, for they were built on occupied land.
Unless there is a reality check and unless there is something done to recognize the oppression that the Israelis are carrying out on that occupied land, nothing is going to change. There is going to be no peace without justice being served.
Israel has made it a priority to change the demographics of Jerusalem outlets and Judaize the city slowly but surely. While Palestinians are the rightful owners of Jerusalem outlets and the international community is against the Israeli regime's illegal settlements, there have not been any moves to stop Israel from advancing its plans.
From drones to missiles, Iran's been enhancing its military and defense capabilities by employing and testing homegrown state-of-the-art technologies. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently released footage portraying the country's latest advancements in the field of drone technology. The footage captured by IRGC drones shows close-up shots of an American aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf. The Defense Force also released a video that showed its kamikaze drones hitting their targets with surgical accuracy. Meanwhile, the head of the U.S. Central Command, which oversees the American forces stationed in the West Asia region, revealed to the U.S. Congress that Iranian drone power has stripped the American Air Force of what the commander called its upper hand in the world. General McKenzie made the comments in written testimony to the House Armed Services Committee, in which he noted how Washington was daunted by Iran's far and wide application of small and medium-sized drones for surveillance and attacks. The top general said Iran's ballistic missile force is the most formidable in the region.
This is something that is going to be very troubling to U.S. government officials because they certainly don't want anybody to have major power except for themselves and some of their allies such as Israel in the Middle East. But as far as the U.S. finally conceding that its power is limited, it's going to take a long time for them to actually recognize that, to face that reality. They're going to work hard to overcome it. spending more money than they already spend on the military, and right now the U.S. spends more on its military than the next 10 nations combined. So it's going to be another kind of arms race, and it will not have a good outcome at all. But hopefully the United States will at some point turn its attentions elsewhere into some other area, either of the world or looking more closely at its own internal problems.
Iran's military says the capabilities have enabled it to nip any security threat in the bud.
I am announcing today that we...
Tensions between Iran and the United States escalated after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew Washington from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign, reinstating sanctions against Tehran and ramping up its military presence in the West Asia region. What happened following the move has been regarded as a test of strength for Iran, not only economically, but also militarily. One instance proving Iran's military advancements occurred on June 20, 2019, when Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps shot down an intruding United States RQ-4A Global Hawk spying drone with a surface-to-air missile over the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has repeatedly said its military capabilities are merely for the defensive purposes and has called for regional cooperation to ensure peace in the Persian Gulf region. In this regard, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani presented a plan dubbed the Hormuz Peace Initiative, or HOPE, which aims at establishing long-term peace in the region, an issue that Iran says is impossible as long as outsiders are present.
This will happen eventually. More and more nations will see that they can rely on Iran. Iran has the strength, Iran has the will, and Iran is looking for peace in the Middle East. The United States is not looking for peace in the Middle East. It has no interest in peace in the Middle East, which is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, why the Iranian government will not work with the United States. Iran is a force to be reckoned with, and the United States has just recognized that in a major way.
But what does the U.S. recognition of Iran's military power amid its waning presence in the region mean for Washington? Only time can tell.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it routinely launches airstrikes against targets in Syria. It is also widely blamed for high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran. The regime is believed to have carried out the recent sabotage attack on Iran's Natanz nuclear facility, which operates under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran was quick to pledge to retaliate for the attack on Natanz. Tel Aviv apparently knows no limit when it comes to clandestine operations against other countries. The regime always says it carries out such actions out of worries for its own security. Such dangerous policies could be starting to backfire. This week, a sensitive missile factory in central Israel was rocked by a powerful blast. The huge explosion, which created a mushroom cloud, hit the Tomer factory for advanced weapons. Israeli officials say the blast was a test. On Thursday, a missile fired from Syria landed near the secretive Dimona nuclear weapons facility, triggering warning sirens. The Israeli military said the projectile was a surface-to-air missile fired by Syrian forces against Israeli warplanes. It says the projectile overflew its target and landed near Dimona. But the heavily protected nuclear facility is some 300 kilometers south of Damascus. It is a very long distance for an errant missile. The missile fired from Syria on Thursday landed just some 30 kilometers away from the notorious Israeli nuclear facility. Military experts say this has once again revealed that much trumpeted Israeli air defenses are penetrable, the projectile made it through the air defense layers despite the fact that anti-aircraft and anti-missile systems around Dimona have been significantly boosted in anticipation of a possible retaliatory missile or drone attack by Iran or resistance groups close to Iran.
By looking at this particular site, Dimona, where this weapon nearly hit, it's saying, well, if you really want to have some sort of fight, you do realise that your nuclear facilities, we know exactly where they are, and they could be hit too. And I'm afraid just simply repeating the lies about the impenetrability of the Israeli air defences and missile defences is not going to save anybody in a conflict. It's really just hot air.
Israeli media, like the Times of Israel, have highlighted the fact that the missile landed deep inside Israel amid heightened tensions with Iran and after Tehran's pledge of retaliation. Some other media organizations, like the Middle East Monitor, said Netanyahu's comments after the attack on Natanz looked like a claim of responsibility, and this may have pushed Iran to retaliate. Israel seems increasingly worried about the possibility of the United States removing sanctions against Iran to re-enter the 2015 nuclear deal that America abandoned under former President Donald Trump. Israel has always been a vociferous critic of the deal, also known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The regime could carry out more covert operations against the Iranians, further raising regional tensions. But if that happens and things spiral out of control, the regime has to be held responsible for possible repercussions for the region and beyond.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are holding talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, trying to salvage the accord. The 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has been at crisis ever since the United States left the pact unilaterally in 2018 and imposed sanctions against Iran. While Tehran's precondition for returning to compliance is removal of all U.S. sanctions, Washington has so far refrained from doing so. U.S. media have cited a source close to America's top nuclear negotiator, Robert Malley, in Vienna, as saying that Washington is opposed to removal of all sanctions imposed on Iran. Current U.S. officials and sources close to American and European negotiators have now been saying that the U.S. is dividing the post-JCPOA sanctions into JCPOA-related and non-JCPOA-related ones, and intends to remove only the former. The presence of numerous Iranian names on the United States' specially designated nationals and blocked persons list, even if apparently unimportant individuals, would also sharply restrict the ceiling for Iran's benefits from the JCPOA. Iran wants these names to also be removed. Iran, meanwhile, is saying that it considers all those sanctions as JCPOA-related because they were imposed with the intent to affect the deal and its implementation, or most recently, the negotiations to revive it. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, says Tehran is proposing a logical path to the U.S. for its full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. He called on the U.S. to return to full compliance first, and then Iran will reciprocate after rapid verification of Washington's compliance. Zarif also stressed that all sanctions imposed by former President Donald Trump must be removed. The main sanctions were imposed on Iran's oil and banking sectors. Speaking to Press TV, Iran's top negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, highlighted Tehran's stance on returning to compliance with the pact.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran, then we would go for full compliance.
The Iranian diplomat also rejected the idea of a step-by-step return to the nuclear accord.
Well, certainly there are sanctions that were imposed under the Trump administration, separate from the JCPOA, that were designed to make it more difficult for the Biden administration to get back into the deal. But the Biden administration had time before it came into the White House, and now it's been 3 months. They have had the time to figure out how to lift those sanctions that were not related to the JCPOA.
During the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump, Washington unilaterally left the JCPOA. Trump reimposed a series of expansive sanctions on Iran that had been lifted under the deal, this time not under the pretext of concerns about Iran's nuclear program, which the JCPOA had already addressed, but under new labels, for instance, so-called sponsorship for terrorism. However, Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, has already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign launched by the previous administration yielded no results. He said Washington is seeking to achieve a mutual return to compliance with the nuclear deal. While the U.S. seems to try to use the sanctions as leverage in the negotiations on the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran has made it clear that it will only return to its commitments under the accord once it has verified that all imposed, reimposed, and relabeled U.S. sanctions against Tehran are removed.
Certainly, if there are remaining sanctions that are having an impact on the Iranian bank, for example, that makes it hard to have transactions with not only the U.S., but countries all over the world, that is problematic. If there continue to be sanctions that make other companies in countries outside the U.S. Worried about doing business with Iran because they continue to be afraid that they will be sanctioned by the United States, that is problematic. And so the U.S. really has to lift all of these sanctions because they are interconnected.
Iran is articulating what should happen in order for the deal to be revived in its original form. By refusing to listen, the United States and Europe are only making it more difficult for the prospect to materialize.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. One of the sweet experiences of the blessed month of Ramadan is to wake up in dawn. It is highly recommended for Muslims to wake up in midnight and eat something before dawn. It is narrated that, at that time, God distributed sustenance for servants, answers prayers, and forgives the sins of those who seek forgiveness. Midnight and the hour before the dawn is the best time for reflecting in creation. That's why it has been highly emphasized in the Islamic ethics to wake up at midnight to pray and think on various aspects of creation. Keeping vigil for prayer, recitation of the Noble Quran, supplication and seeking God's forgiveness are among the acts that have been stressed to do in Midnight and Dawn. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says in a famous hadith, that is Hadith al-Mi'raj, when a servant is in communion with God, supplicating with him, God will radiate the light of faith in his heart and will make his heart firm. Then he will call the angels, "My angels,